Are you struggling to grow your accounting firm? Did you know that the biggest barrier to accounting firm growth is the lack of effective workflow software? You need a tool to work efficiently, keep clients happy, and help your firm run smoothly. Stay tuned to hear more from our sponsor, Client Hub, later in the episode.
Streaming, when Netflix is creating its own product and then just putting it on this platform, there is no license fee to obtain after that, you know, right? Because they're just creating the content and then putting it on their platform, and they are earning their revenue from subscription fees. So I'm paying, let's say, $20 a month for Netflix. How do you allocate that $20 a month to the shows that I watched, you know?
If you'd like to earn CPE credit for listening to this episode, visit earmarkcpe.com. Download the app, take a short quiz, and get your CPE certificate. Continuing education has never been so easy. And now, on to the episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. I'm Blake Oliver, CPA, and joining me today is Kendale King, CPA. Kendale, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Kendale has demonstrated strong aptitude and an interest in accounting from a very young age. He obtained his associate's degree while still in high school, then continued his education by simultaneously earning his master's degree and CPA. Kendale kickstarted his career at Deloitte, where he audited major companies. Seeking more fulfilling work, he transitioned into media and entertainment accounting. He held roles serving prominent clients at a consulting firm and also worked at Netflix. This experience enabled Kendale to ultimately launch his own practice, specializing in media production and crypto assets. And I'm really eager to talk to you today, Kendale, about your practice and your background. So, yeah, great to have you. I guess for my first question, I got to say, what was your favorite, what's been your favorite gig in the entertainment industry so far?
Man, I mean, just hearing it back like that sounds interesting. I'm like, man, I did all that, huh? I think that my favorite gig, you know, in the actual, you know, entertainment space, you know, because Netflix was a dream job for me at the time because, you know, obviously I watched Netflix and I'm just like, oh, I want to, you know, be there and everything. But honestly, you know, I'm a guy that really needs a challenge and needs to be stimulated. And Netflix was real, like, together, you know, they had already had all their stuff together. So it didn't really lead me to be able to do much at the time. And so I guess my favorite, oh man, it's hard to pick a favorite. I'm gonna pick a couple. Let me do that.
Okay.
I think one of the I worked at a consulting firm where I was able to, you know, when Disney was buying Fox, they couldn't get all of the sports networks because Fox, you know, Fox Sports Networks, and then Disney already had ESPN, so they weren't able to get those. So we had to do a separation of those, you know, networks and like create financial statements for them from scratch. And they had never had financial statements before. So it was like, I think 15 different entities that we needed to create them for so that investors could use it. And mm-hmm. I feel like that was just real cool to me because I had like literally just got out of doing auditing, you know, and like auditing financial statements, you know, forever. And then it's like, oh, now you got to make them up from scratch with some things that never had it before. You know, more times than not, you have like, you know, Sally, right? You can use this thing, things from last year, but this, we had to do it from scratch. And it was a really interesting experience there working.
Wow. Yeah. That does sound fascinating.
Yeah. It was cool because we had to do them each standalone and then all of them combined. You know, so we had to do different versions of them. The one thing I didn't care for is that, you know, with all of the like 10-Ks and stuff like that, they get real nitpicky on like the wording. I'm like, all right, you know, that you can miss me on that stuff. But, you know, putting together the numbers and making it happen was pretty cool. And then one thing is like you see this pillow right here in my background. It's a logo of a convention that I work with. I handle all of the finances, and it's a convention called DreamCon. And it's really a big piece of my heart, honestly. You know, since I started working with them back in 2021, it literally is a entertainment convention focused on, you know, the anime, gaming, media, you know, just content creators, all of it. And it was really something, and it's really like focused as well on like the Black group, especially because, more times than not in different places, they dress up as somebody else, as somebody else's favorite character, they kind of get ridiculed and everything. And so it was like creating a space where you could feel like yourself. And I'm a huge comic book fan, as you can see with the, the things over here. So it was really great. It was really great.
Describe for our listeners what you have in the background there.
Oh, yes. Yes. So like I mentioned, this is a pillow logo for DreamCon. That is a crown because my last name is King. That is a money sign. That is an actual money tree. And then, I had some movies here, some of my favorite movies. Huge Will Smith fan. So a lot of those up there are probably Will Smith. And then I have some of these bobblehead. What would you call these things? Pops. Yeah. These I got that one actually from Netflix. That's from Stranger Things. And then, just some of my influences. So, Star Wars and Avatar, The Last Airbender. I love Mickey Mouse, from a young age. Black Panther. So it's just kind of, I'm still adding to it, but it's like a representation of kind of, obviously the money side and everything like that, but also, the media and, the gaming, the TV, all the stuff that I love.
So tell me about Deloitte. Like, what was it like to work at Deloitte? Are you one of the people who says like, it was a great experience, I'm so glad I did it, or is the Big Four all it's cracked up to be?
I mean, I don't really get in the habit of bad mouthing anything, but I will say, obviously, we all know what corporate America is. I enjoyed my time at Deloitte, but by the time I was leaving, I was happy to go, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it was real more so on the line of, I really wanted to do more. And like Deloitte had a plan for you. It's like you do, and again, just Big Four in general, you do 2 years here, then you become a senior, then you do another 2-3 years, you become a manager, another 2-3 years. And like, they really wanted you to stay in that box. And it's like, for me, I'm just like, how do I get to this? Any place I come into, I look at the top and I'm looking like, all right, how can I get up there? What's the best way, fastest way, most rewarding way I can get to the top? And with Deloitte and again, Big Four in general, it was just like, oh, well, you do this. And, sure, there are some times when people maybe can skip, or do something a little early, but that's not really what we want. We want you to, spend as much time and get the blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, no, I'm good. I don't want that. Like, give me what I need. I want to move. I was real ambitious. And so it was good to learn a lot of like basics, a lot of soft skills, how to manage, kind of difficult conversations, how to deal with, people who were, in a position that they feel like they were being attacked. And so how to, communicate properly. And so it was just a lot of different, skills that I've learned. And so I'm definitely grateful for the years I was there. But like I said, by the time I left, I was, I really wasn't looking back.
Mm-hmm. So you left for media and entertainment and moved all the way across the country, about as far as you can get, to LA. Is that right? Like, how did you make that leap? How did you make that transition? Not just physical distance, but also like going from audit to entertainment. That's a big shift.
It is. But for me, I was already setting myself up to make the change because I was even like, within Deloitte, I did a very, very small stint on like the NBC audit that they had at the time. And I was being very intentional on setting myself up to be able to get into the entertainment industry that way. And honestly, I was actually going to go to New York first. The partner on the engagement at the time, had pulled some strings to be able to get me into the NBC audit, because it was like one that was in Los Angeles and it was one that was in New York, and I wanted the one in LA, but that was already pulled, but he was able to pull some strings for New York. And so I was like, okay, well, I didn't really want to go to New York per se, but it is still a place where it was like, media, entertainment, all that stuff like that. And so I was like, all right, let me work within the confines that I have But then a manager at the time, you know, a really great guy that I, you know, worked with, he was like, Kendall, you know, you don't have to work for Deloitte, right? He was like, you know, you can leave. And I was like, oh, yeah, I can go somewhere else. And so that was the thought process. So that's where I took some interviews to go to, you know, a different, you know, consulting firm out in Los Angeles. Number one was really just to make sure I had some income when I got over there. But also, you know, it was a great one because you were able to, you know, get to a project, not know anything, have to figure stuff out, have to provide an answer and like, you know, make it go. And so it was really good experience as well to be able to switch gears and be able to help people in their problems. And it's not the same problem. Like with audit, it was like, you know, it's the audit is the audit. You know, you're going to do the same procedures basically every year. But here it was like, all right, you got to do this. Now you got to do that. Now you got to do this at this project. And it's totally different. And so it helped a lot. So yeah, for me, I wasn't scared. You know, I think the way I grew up is like, you know, I was always being like able to kind of take that leap and go out and, you know, do things. And so, and my brother actually was already out in Los Angeles. So my older brother, he's a choreographer, dancer, talent agent. At the time, he was already out in Los Angeles, already had a presence there. So it wasn't as hard of a transition either because, you know, it just went with him at first and then, you know, ventured out on my own.
So you mentioned at the top of the episode that you did that carve out project for 21st Century Fox, where you had to pull out 16 entities that had never been reported on separately before. Your LinkedIn also says that you worked for Caesars, you worked on Caesars Entertainment, you worked on Snap.
Yep.
Which one of those do you want to talk about? Because I would love to hear about both. They both sound fascinating.
So, I mean, I can do a brief about both of them, but yeah. You know, Caesars was my first one coming out of audit, and it was in the financial reporting. And so it's like that was where, again, literally I was just auditing these financial statements, and now I'm like, you know, helping to, you know, create them. And so, you know, it was good to be able to see the other side of it. But it was a real short term engagement, but it was a cool experience. You know, learned like how the other side of it worked and how financials like were, you know, technically put together as far as the financial reporting team. Not much accounting was really there. It was just really just helping present, you know, the financials. So that was the first project. Then I went to the Disney carve out project. Then I did a brief audit project. You know, with an Embraer, it was like an airplane company. And so that was back to audit. But it was like the reason I did that was purely because of the money. They pay like a bonus, a surplus to, you know, do the audit. So I was like, all right, well, I'll do that. And then Snap. Yeah. So Snap, they were looking for some help in the accounting department. And I came in and helped them with that for a few months as well. So that was like one, you know, again, a great one because it wasn't, you know, when you think of media entertainment, you don't necessarily think of Snapchat. You think maybe tech and everything. But I'm like, also, that is kind of, you know, included in media entertainment. You know, they have, you know, they're creating productions. And at the time, they were just kind of getting into doing those like original Snaps productions and stuff. And so it was pretty cool to be able to see that and, you know, help with the accounting at that point. But yeah, it was cool.
It's amazing how much content is now delivered by and consumed on mobile apps, right? We've got YouTube has YouTube Shorts now. We've got amazing quantities of content being created and consumed on TikTok and Instagram. They really are media empires. And I guess that's why, is Snap in Santa Monica?
Yes, Snap is in, it's in Santa Monica as well.
Yeah. Well, so we got to talk about Netflix. You had a role as a content accountant, original series. So was this was a situation where you were assigned to a specific series?
So I was assigned to the way it was broken up back then. Again, I don't know how it is right now, but back then it was broken up basically by genre, essentially. So I had like the drama. I did some of the comedy and some of the young adult stuff as well. So you know, it without those were, and that was actually what I wanted. I wanted to, I'm a huge drama, you know, TV guy. And so being able to do the, you know, get in and do the drama stuff, I was like, okay, this was definitely what I want. And honestly, the interview process for Netflix was something totally different. And I actually, you know, went in for a different job just because I'm like, all right, I want to get in. I want to make it happen. But ended up in the place I actually wanted to be in. So it was pretty cool. And yeah, it was good. It, like, I mean, and again, accounting is, you know, at the, you know, you got a corporate level accounting, right, where you're doing the leases and the, you know, all the basic accounting stuff for any business. But then content accounting specifically is looking at that asset, you know, and the liability of, you know, of creating content or purchasing content from other, you know, individuals and other businesses. So that's what, you know, I was in, you know, responsible for, was helping to track the cost, make payments to, you know, the vendors as it related to, you know, content, recognizing the revenue, amortizing, you know, the COGS over the life of the series and stuff like that. And that was my very, very big first basic, like real in-depth understanding of entertainment accounting, which is interesting because Netflix had rewrote the rules on how to, you know, account for entertainment accounting because the streaming model. So it was an interesting, you know, thing to learn.
Tell me more about that, because I don't remember learning about production accounting or entertainment accounting when I took my accounting courses. What, well, how was it done in the past? And then how did Netflix change this?
So, I mean, it's still there, you know, there's other studios that are still using it. And, you know, Netflix does kind of still use some of the concepts. But the main difference is that, you know, in a regular studio, right, you are creating an asset. So all your development costs that are going into it, paying for, you know, actors to act in it, paying for the accountants on the show to do with the crew, casting crew, everything like that. You know, all those costs are built up. And then the accounting team creates what's called an ultimate that is forecasting out how much revenue this particular product, this particular content is, you know, forecasted to essentially make, right? And you usually, you know, there's several different, you know, methods that people use, but usually it's over a period of between like 5 to 10 years, depending on the actual, you know, content. But what that was before streaming, right? So more times than not, when an asset was created, it was then sold, right? It was sold to a network. That network would pay a license fee, and that would then they would also potentially have, you know, syndication and selling it in different, you know, jurisdictions around the world. And so there was all these ways to, you know, points to make money and amortize based off of those you know, batches of money. But with streaming, when Netflix is creating its own product and then just putting it on this platform, there is no license fee to obtain after that, you know, right? Because they're just creating the content and then putting it on their platform, and they are earning their revenue from subscription fees. So I'm paying, let's say, $20 a month for Netflix. How do you allocate that $20 a month to the shows that I watched, you know, because technically that $20 should be, you know, allocated across, like, all right, well, Kendall paid for, you know, his subscription, and he watched, you know, Squid Games. And so that's the only thing he watched. You know, how do we, you know, do we allocate the full 20 to Squid Games as revenue? Do, you know, so I mean, obviously that process could get pretty tiring. And so what happens is, you know, they create, you know, again, sort of like an ultimate for their purposes, but it's a different curve that they, you know, use, and they base it off of their history of subscriber, you know, revenue and growth. And, you know, usually, you know, the metrics that they have inside, you know, that says, you know, actually we should be amortizing this over, you know, a shorter period. I forget what the period is for them. I think it's around 3 years or 5 years, but don't quote me on that. But it's a shorter period that they're amortizing, you know, over, because their data is telling them that, you know, this revenue is, you know, something that is, you know, it's a lot of content, a lot of titles. And so putting it over, you know, these specific titles is next to impossible. And so they just kind of do it over their whole library. And that's what the data tells them.
Interesting. Yeah. So in the past, studios were creating assets that they would then sell. And it was fairly simple, I suppose, to capitalize that asset and then sell it. Or if you don't sell it, at least match it up to the income streams from that asset, which, like you said, include the royalties. It could include license deals, that sort of thing. But when Netflix is the platform for distribution and they create these assets, allocating all the subscription revenue to these individual assets becomes a challenge because our subscription, you know, we might watch a bunch of different shows. We might watch no shows. And how could you efficiently, effectively allocate revenue? It seems almost like impossible. So is it fair to say they don't even try to allocate the subscription revenue to these individual productions?
Well, I mean, there are... They have a lot of data, a lot of metrics. They gather that, like, you know, it's whole separate departments, you know, solely focused on the data piece. And so I don't remember us, you know, actually attributing any revenue to it. But again, they look at watch hours, right? They're looking at how many of all the total hours that are being used. Here's how much is being, you know, sent to here. And so while I don't believe that they actually attribute that to those specific shows, because at that point, it's not even really necessary, right? Because at the end of the day, you just need the financials to reflect the revenue that you have overall, not necessarily coded per show, but they use those other metrics to understand the success of the show. You know, and that's where, you know, it's like, oh, this is a top 10 most watched show. And it's always changing. It's always updating because that's a full-time job of someone and a team that is looking at these numbers and updating based off of that activity.
Got it. So in a traditional studio, the success of the show would be determined by its, you know, net profit or net income. But in a Netflix situation, it's all these non-financial metrics that determine if the show is successful. And I suppose they probably compare that to the cost to produce the show, right? There's shows that are super cheap. And then there's shows like, you know, The Queen, which I'm sure cost a fortune, right? So that's fascinating.
The Crown, the big one.
I saw an article recently. Maybe you could shed some light on this for me. It was in The Hollywood Reporter, and it was about how Netflix is shelving Halle Berry's The Mothership. Did you hear about this?
No, I missed that one.
So Halle Berry, she starred in a sci-fi movie, The Mothership, that Netflix produced. And The Hollywood Reporter said that Netflix decided that they're just going to shelve the film and not release it. And it has something to do with tax benefits of it. So I suppose, like, if they don't release the film, they can just write off all the costs immediately. They don't have to amortize it or something like that?
Well, yes. I didn't read the full article. I was kind of just looking right now. But from hearing what you're saying, I can definitely just speculate a bit on that. Is that, you know, when you're creating an asset, right? Those costs should be hitting your balance sheet first, right? Building up your content asset. And then once you actually, you know, once Netflix actually puts it on air, you know, at that point starts the clock of the amortization. So if they're saying that, you know what, we're not going to put this out there, then, and they believe it's a dead project at that point in time, then all of that should be immediately flushed down into the, you know, to the P&L at the point in time. Oh. There's also a 3-year rule. Yeah, there's also a 3-year rule that, you know, that says that, you know, if you have an asset that you have been putting in development and those costs that are accrued, even if you are trying to still sell it and everything like that, technically you should be pushing those costs down to the, you know, to the income statement at that point in time, unless you got a very, very valid reason that you believe that this is about to be, sold or, you know, put on the market.
It's interesting. Thank you for shedding light on that.
But yeah, sounds definitely like a tax thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, it makes a lot of sense now. And I was trying to figure it out before, but I guess I didn't understand that I figured that all of the content that Netflix makes is because they, you know, they're just streaming this on their own platforms, that it would be expensed, but they're actually capitalizing and amortizing. And so this way they can just accelerate that. But it's sad because, you know, I'd love to see this movie. Unfortunately, the accounting treatment doesn't treat the viewer as well, or the fans well.
Yeah, and honestly, I was like, you know, if I was on the team, or if I was, you know, the regulators on that, I'm like, you're going to have to give me a better reason as to why you're not going to be, you know, displaying this, other than just because you want the write-off. Mm-hmm. And so there has to be, you know, even if it's just on paper, it has to be another reason as to why this isn't being, you know, exploited. Because if you start doing that, then, I mean, what's stopping you? You know, what's stopping studios from doing that at any point in time? Like, that's why there's rules and policies set in place for, you know, how these assets are capitalized and when you're going to write them off, when you're going to keep them on the balance sheet. So people won't be able to play with the numbers like that. Not saying that people still don't. You know, studios still don't do that. But, you know, at least you got to have some type of rhyme or reason of what you're doing.
Well, I mean, that's where the term Hollywood accounting comes from, right?
Exactly.
So I just learned.
Exactly. And
I just learned about this term from our from like some articles about Disney in a lawsuit with folks. Could you just, for our listeners who've never encountered this term before, kind of explain this concept of Hollywood accounting? Because I love it because it shows just how creative we can be as accountants in making that, you know, bottom line number look how the studios want it to look.
Yep. So Hollywood accounting is a term that is generally used for, you know, is more being used more in like a deceptive light, where studio accountants or studio execs are trying to, even though a film is very successful, that they're trying to make it look like it's not on paper so that they don't have to pay out certain participations to individuals or certain residuals to individuals, which are all based on, you know, the accounting, right? So for example, within every contract that, you know, actors are, you know, going through, you know, they get their residuals based on the SAG negotiations and everything like that. But also certain key actors and talent are also able to get participations, which is, again, participating in the back end of the success of the show, essentially. But with that being said, those calculations can be really complex because it's like you can get X percentage on net gross revenue after considering these particular things and who's in charge of saying what's what, like who was in the bucket and everything like that. So a lot of times, again, historically, you know, there are some thoughts on how, you know, hey, I have to think a big one was like a Harry Potter or something, but where it was just like it was a huge, huge success. But, you know, the actors are like, where our money, where our piece of the pie at? But again, they weren't getting it because, you know, they were including the executives were including and the accountants were including costs and stuff that was kind of like borderline, you know, you know, can you really do that in order to reduce the, you know, the end all amount that, you know, that was really owed to the talent at the time. So there's plenty of cases on it. And actually, you know, I mentioned to you earlier that I have a podcast now that is called Hollywood Accounting. And in that podcast, it's really just generally just talking about like the accounting in the, you know, in the Hollywood industry. So like music, you know, productions and, you know, sports and everything like that. But, you know, I have a tangent series specifically looking at, you know, some deceptive, you know, things, some frauds that have happened in the media industry as well, to kind of go behind the numbers and see that stuff. But to your point, it definitely is the, you know, kind of the nod to how intelligent accountants and how tricky it can be.
We didn't learn about Hollywood accounting in school, but it reminds me of like the allocation of manufacturing overhead, where you know you take production overhead, distribution overhead, marketing, and you push that down into the productions, right? So that increases your costs and it lowers your profit. And then if all the contracts are written based on profit, you could see how that would upset perhaps some of the lead actors who get a profit share. And then they would accuse the studios of you know, manipulating the numbers. My takeaway from all this is if I'm ever a participant, you know, if I ever get points on a production, it's to negotiate on top line revenue, right? Like don't, if you can.
Well, you're more likely not going to get that. You know, it's just not standard to do that. But I think the main thing really is to that point is, and sometimes obviously depending on the deal, you might not even have that much negotiating power, or more times than not, a lot of actors want to see it on the front end instead of the back end. And I think that's just a mindset thing, honestly. But the main thing I would say though, you know, is just getting another accountant, you know, having your accountant, you know, or financial manager, you know, audit these, because they're open for audits, you know. And so more times than not, you know, you can kind of get your, you know, your own representative, your own creative accountant, you know, to go in there and say, hey, you know, why are you guys including X, Y, and Z? You know, why is this being done? And let's take that out. That doesn't fit this, you know, this definition. And so a lot of times people don't have, you know, an accountant to do that, or don't even know that they have audit rights. You know, a lot of times they just take what, you know, what is given to them. And so there's a whole business out there for people who audit these, you know, type of contracts and participation statements and everything like that, just to make sure that the studios aren't, you know, kind of gaming them.
Get yourself an accountant. Audit those financials. You have a right to do it. That's great to know. We got to push that message to all the content creators, all the creatives out there. You need a good accountant.
Look, that's my whole mission, man. That's the whole mission is, you know, you don't like a lot of the content creators and talent that I've like worked with or talked to is like, they don't, you know, certain things that we went through as, you know, just going in through the business courses and accounting courses, it's like second nature. It's like, oh, yeah, of course. Why aren't you asking about, you know, these particular points in the contract? Why aren't you questioning, you know, X, Y, and Z? Why aren't you looking over, you know, certain things? It's like, it's just not second nature to them. They just, you know, it's like, all right, let's just get the deal done. You know, let's just move on. Let's just do this. Let's do that. And more times than not, a lot of people, a lot of, you know, talent in general, just a lot of businesses in general, just look at accountants or the accounting function as a, like a call center. It's like, I don't really need to do that right now. Or, you know, oh, I just need them for taxes. That's it. But my whole thing of how I, you know, provide services and provide value, to my clients is I'm a revenue generating, like, you know, center for me. You know, I'm like, I'm helping you make sure you're maximizing your revenue to the most and reducing your costs, you know, as much as possible beyond just tax savings. You know, I was able to look into a client's contract that was, you know, they had with the platform that they were partnered with. And I was just like, these numbers just seem a little high to me. You know, I'm just like, I didn't know it was wrong. But I was just like, it just feels wrong to me. And so I just asked them, like, can you give me how you got these numbers? And they were on auto, like, debit. So they were just taking the money out. And just to be, again, fair, the front, it's not like they were doing this deceptively. But, you know, but these things happen where, you know, I looked at the numbers and I started questioning. I was like, well, this looks like you're getting, you know, this much and this much. And then looking at the contracts, like, you're only supposed to get that much. And it saved, you know, the company like $25,000. You know, just from doing that one, just by asking the question, like, do these numbers look right? Checking the contracts and making sure. And so if I was brought in on the front end on that, you know, it would have been, we wouldn't even have that problem, but it's always, you know, it's never too late, you know, especially if you have a good relationship with the vendor and they, you know, again, they're not actually doing anything wrong, like intentionally, you know, getting that remedy, you know, on the back end and having the audit, you know, ability is great. because people get taken advantage of, especially in the media entertainment space, content creators, you know, they're not business people, they're content creators, you know?
Yeah. And you've got their back now with your own firm. You founded KCK CPA. You've been doing that for coming up on 2 years.
So technically, like the actual organization of the thing, yes. But I've been doing like this work since I moved out here to LA. Honestly, a little bit before LA, because, you know, again, my brother was a choreographer. And he was in the talent space as well. And so, you know, and him and his friends were in it. And so, you know, in between time and, you know, when I wasn't working my full-time job, I was doing things like that. And so it just got to a point where it was like, all right, now, you know, I have enough clients to kind of just do this full time. And so that's where, you know, a few years ago, did it full time, going forward.
So tell me about your firm. I understand it's a small team. It's boutique. Is that a fair word to use? Boutique?
That's cool.
You're focused, right? And you offer a high level of service. Like, what kind of services do you offer to your clients? How do you package up what you are doing for them?
Yeah. So again, initially started with Account by K&J, K&J Strategic Financial, which is a firm that me and my wife at the time had like created. And she's also CPA. And, you know, so, but it was really me kind of like pushing, like, hey, I want to start a firm, let's do this together and everything like that. So honestly, I kind of, you know, pushed her into it. But, you know, we started it there, and it was to help, you know, small businesses at first. So we were just looking at small businesses. But then as I kind of more went into it, I just knew that, you know, people were telling me all the time, like, you need to niche down, you know, you need to find your market and do that. And, you know, when you first start a business, you know, you want to just get as much as possible, right? You want to just, let me get over all this stuff, let me secure the bag, you know, let me do all this. And so that was the main thing at the beginning. But over time, as I started, you know, you're really getting further into the industry, you know, KCK CPA was again crafted to be able to do that focus. You know, I realized, like, you know what, okay, I really truly have a passion and, you know, and a mindset to do this right. And this is what's providing me the most value. Cause the other one is like, you know, the bookkeeping and taxes and stuff like that. It's like, you know, that's just real, you know, commonplace stuff. I'm like, all right, you know, you don't need, you know, me to do that, honestly. You know, and so for me, I was like, let me figure out a way where I can provide true value. And that's where, again, KCK CPA, providing business management, financial management services for those in the media space. I also have studio clients as well, helping them with their accounting. But I negotiate contracts for people. I make sure to, strategize. I also call myself like a financial architect of sorts. And that's a connection back to, you know, when I first started, in architecture. So I can't draw, but I can definitely create, you know, streams of revenue. So I help with, you know, talent to see the bigger picture and be able to monetize and, you know, take advantage of opportunities that come up, strategize. I'm a huge strategist when it comes to, you know, a lot of the people that I work with and, you know, just kind of taking, like, and I understand the media industry. I have a creative mind, but I'm also, you know, very much grounded and rooted in financial literacy and management. And so, you know, I really like to think of myself with KCK CPA is, you know, I'm not necessarily, even though I can, I'm not the person who's, you know, creating your business. Like, I'm not creating your LLC. You know, I'm not, you know, again, I'm not necessarily just filing your tax. You know, you're not just kind of stopping with me at one time a year with taxes and everything like that. Like, honestly, you might as well just find somebody else to do that stuff. But if you want to have to really elevate and scale your business and scale what you're doing and, you know, take it to that very next level and continue to grow and to figure out how do you squeeze every last drop of, you know, lemon juice out the lemon type thing. It's just like, that's where I come in and help get that to the next level. And obviously, you know, if I'm doing that for you, then I'll do the taxes and I'll make sure my team, I have a team that, again, will help with, you know, putting together LLCs and stuff like that. But if that's, if you're just starting, I'm probably not the best for you. You need to, you know, again, I can give you some advice and help you out, but I'm more of the person you come to and it's like, look, I've done very well, or I'm doing really good on my own. Now I'm getting to a point where I feel like I'm missing out on stuff, or it's getting too hard to do this alone. And, you know, I really need help getting to that next level.
It sounds like you've got it really figured out, like exactly the kind of client that you want to serve. And I'm curious, how do you price these kind of engagements? Because it sounds like there could be a lot going on with these clients who are like doing well. They've got more than they can handle. And I know for a lot of CPAs that ends up being like the reason that they struggle to do fixed pricing and they revert to hourly pricing. How are you pricing your services? Are you doing it hourly? Are you doing fixed fees? Are you doing value pricing? Is it something else?
It's a combination of everything, because that's a good point, is that when I first, you know, started in it, I didn't really like the thought of the hourly pricing, because I didn't want my clients to feel like they on the clock. You know, they can't like ask me questions because this isn't, you know, accruing some more money. But I now, after, you know, years of doing it, just want a flat fee. I understand that the hourly pricing helps, you know, me, the professional, to be able to manage time properly, especially as we scale. So it's honestly a mix. I think now, you know, I charge hourly for certain engagements like studios and stuff like that, that may make more sense for them. But then for, you know, some creators, again, and some, you know, other, you know, clients, you know, I do more of a flat fee, but this flat fee is a lot higher than the other, like in the past were, to basically incorporate, you know, a lot more stuff. In some cases, also percentages, you know, again, if I'm bringing in deals, and I'm landing them, and, you know, same way as any other talent manager or business manager would, you know, get percentages on. And so I'm not gonna lie, I'm not the price guru. And honestly, more times than not, I try to provide value first before I'm like, oh yeah, is this much? You know, and that's a not the most sustainable business model. But it's just like, for me, it's just like, I really just want to prove to you, like, look, I got your back, we in this. And so like, it don't matter how much I charge, you're gonna want me on the team because I'm bringing you in more money at the end of the day. And so for me, it's been from, you know, very low flat fees to hourly fees to, you know, how much I can bring back for you, a percentage of that. So just it varies, honestly, on different types of services. No, I'm saying, I don't know if that was the best answer, but, you know, it's a range.
No, I think that's great. I mean, there is no one answer, right? That's what I've found. And it's often a mix. I did fixed fees with my practice, but we also had some hourly clients too. So I think that's fair. So for our listeners who are interested in specializing in like the kind of work that you do, entertainment, media, we talked about how you don't really learn that in school. Do you have any recommendations for how they could get this knowledge or areas they should focus on in accounting while they're students?
Yep. So, I mean, if you're a student, I think that if you truly understand like cost accounting, inventory accounting, then it'll be a pretty easy, you know, transfer over into, you know, media entertainment accounting. Because again, like you mentioned, again, it's all about like allocations and buildup of an asset and, you know, everything like that. So I say, again, if you're a student and you're just trying to kind of learn what's in, you know, what they have, then that's one thing. I am actually on a mission to bring more entertainment, more, you know, newer alternative ways of accounting into college curriculums as well. So I'm on the board of Cal CPA, out here, and I'm also the president of NABA, the NABA chapter of Los Angeles. And so I'm not saying it's easy, but I'm trying to make some change in how that is, done. But I also, among me and then some other people too, other sources out there, you can just, if you're a continuing professional, you want CPE, or even if you're just, you're just eager, there's programs out there that teaches you how to do production accounting. There's not as many out there that do like corporate entertainment, ultimate accounting, but there's quite a few out there that does like production accounting, which is, when you're an accountant on the set of a particular show. And so, there's, different things out there that you can learn from. And obviously the best thing, in my opinion, is to get in the experience. But I have courses. I'm certified with as a CPE sponsor with NASBA to be able to give out CPEs for the courses that I create. And so I have a course as it relates to, ultimate accounting, a course on, I do crypto as well. It was important to know about crypto, to be the best, advocate for the client, since in my opinion, crypto, blockchain, NFTs, they're very closely associated with, the entertainment space, with artists, royalties and gaming, and open world universes and everything like that. And so I teach those type of courses where, again, you can also get CPE if you're a professional and you want that as well. But there's literally, you can just, I would always say Google it. You can Google out there and see what things exist. Stick to listening to, sources and podcasts like this that opens up your mind and allows you to, see the different areas. You can obviously just go into the FASB itself and look at the accounting and how it's done. You could do that. Or again, you can just have guys like me who explain it to you. Yeah. So either one is, it just really depends on, what your avenue is.
How did you get into the crypto accounting space? I know there's crossover with NFTs and entertainment and crypto. What was your entree into that whole space? Like,
the sad moment, I tell you, is back in 2014, I had went to a Bitcoin crypto seminar. And I was like, oh, I knew at the time, this is the future. This is what's going to happen. But again, that was when Bitcoin was nothing. It was when it wasn't worth much of anything. But the guy was giving out 0.01 of Bitcoin at the time, just for free, just for participating. So I was like, yeah, I'll take that. Thanks. And so, set up a wallet and did all this stuff and got the Bitcoin at that point in time. And, life happens. And so you just kind of forget, and it wasn't the big thing on the mind. And again, I had a one track focus of getting through school and getting into, doing a CPA, all this good stuff. So I forgot about it until 2017, 2018, when it made that first jump, that first huge jump. And I was like, I know I got some Bitcoin around here somewhere. And I found the account, got in there, and that 0.01 ended up being $280 at the time. And I was floored because in my mind, I'm just thinking of all the amount of money that I'd had where I could have just put a dollar here, $1,000, at one thing, doing that, and I'd have been set. And so it was a very sick moment for me at that point in time. And I was just like, all right, I can't let that happen again. I don't want to be left in the background anymore. And so that's when I really went hard into, understanding crypto and the blockchain and everything like that. And so as I, continued to grow, and then when I really made that set, that jump to do full-time my own, businesses. That's where, again, I even went even deeper and heavier into, crypto, where I was even working with the FASB and still do now on, the pronouncements that are coming out. So the fair value, an announcement that recently just took effect, I helped in that process of getting it to the finish line. So yeah, that's my initial foray into the space. But yeah, I was in you know, I was in the community. I got rugged. I got, I went to the, the alpha sessions. I was in it. Wow. I was like, let me be a participant of this, and really understand. So, yeah.
Well, that's so cool that you've been working with FASB. What is that like? FASB seems like this mysterious, Wizard of Oz kind of organization. Like what is it? Who are these people? How do you get things done?
Look, I honestly, at the time when I was like really getting into the crypto really heavy, and I knew that they were, when I first had, I saw it's on the agenda now. We're going to talk about, doing some accounting for crypto. I had literally went onto the FASB website and saw all the people in who was working on the project and sent them an email. It's like, hey, I do this. Let me know. I'm in the community. I would love to be a part of this. Cause in my mind, I'm like, this is history. This is this is an accounting moment, for CPAs to look back in the future to be like, I can say I was on that one back in the day. That was me in my little rocking chair.
That's right.
I had reached out, and I reached out several times because at first they were ignoring me. Or maybe they just didn't see it. I don't know. But Nick Capiello actually reached out to me, and he was like, hey, we're always interested to hear from stakeholders and stuff like that. So at first he sent me a scope test, essentially, of how to scope what crypto assets, what blockchain technology should be included in this first round of of regulation. And so, going through that process with him, talking to him about that, giving him my opinion, I'm like, well, yeah, if you're going to go by this definition, then these things need to be pushed to the side. We shouldn't be talking about this just yet. I helped, organize, the FASB, him and his team, talk with people, companies that existed in the space, connected them with their accountants or their teams, to be able to have that conversation. Because again, the FASB, like you said, is this Wizard of Oz. They weren't necessarily on the ground. And mm-hmm. so I was able to say, all right, look, I'm on the ground out here. Let me connect you guys with these stakeholders who this accounting is going to eventually affect. And then in those meetings, some of those companies don't know. They just given, what the actual accounting treatment should be. They just know what they do. And so it was just having FASB on one side, them on the other side, and then me in the middle to just kind of be able to, help that conversation along. It's like, all right, well, yeah, that makes sense here. That makes sense over here. Here's, in my opinion, where we should kind of really be going. And so just doing conversations like that with them. And again, the accounting, the pronouncement that came out is great, fair value. But honestly, that was the low hanging fruit of crypto, honest to be real. It's like there's so many other complex, situations to consider that hasn't even been touched. As far as, I know some of the conversations are happening, but I was even talking to Nick. I'm like, yeah, man, we got some work to do. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. What happens when, you create your own token? Is that inventory? Is that, should you not, right now, people don't even show it on their balance sheet sometimes because it's like, well, It's in the contract. Yeah, I don't own it. It's in the smart contract. It's like, well, but you control the contract, don't you? You created it, so that's technically yours. And you should be valuing what that crypto is worth based on how much money you put into it. And that should show on your balance sheet, because if not, it's just going to be it's off balance sheet right now until it's used. And it's just I feel in my personal opinion that it should be shown. You should recognize that you have the ability to flood the market if you wanted to with these assets, something like that, so it's just, but people have different opinions on different things. And so it's healthy to have those conversations to get those different point of views.
You're giving me Enron flashbacks with this off balance sheet discussion. I'm just actually reading the book. Finally, The Smartest Guys in the Room. Finally, I'm reading that. Never read it before. And it's like the exact same problem that you're talking about, where they had control over these other entities, but they didn't consolidate them on the balance sheet because they had, some reason not to. If we don't solve this in crypto, maybe we could have that happen again.
And honestly, and it's kind of happened already, and it's happening, right? When you see FTX, and the problem with FTX is that they just didn't have proper accounting. You know, they didn't have a proper like person who really understood. And a lot of people like to say like, you know, the regulation, it doesn't exist. So people, you know, how can you blame people? But it's just like, yeah, sure, there isn't an abundance of regulation, but there are things like any reasonable accountant, you know, who understands the technology and understands the business, you know that, all right, this is something I should be disclosing, or this is a treatment that maybe we should be doing. But I think more times than not, you know, in the startup space in general, a lot of times it's always just showing the best numbers you can to get the next investment, right? You know, doing what you can to show, to make it look like it's working, so that you can get the next round, so that you can, you know, put more money in it to make it actually work. And I think that, you know, with crypto being in the startup space, you know, in general, it just perpetuated that problem as well. And more times than not, again, the accounting in the smart startup space, you know, for any new businesses are always lacking. That's the biggest thing in my opinion. But yes, it's definitely possible, because it's like, well, there's no strict requirement to do it, so we don't have to do it. Either you're saving money or you're trying to mislead some people. You know, those are different ways that, you know, have happened and can still continue to happen if, you know, we don't really make this a priority.
Kendale, I just want to do a quick time check. I know we're over. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on before I wrap things up?
For me, I think that, AI. So obviously AI is a big one. And again, I'm on that too. I actually created, I don't know if this is the actual truth or not, but I created the first CPA GPT. Definitely if you guys are interested in hearing, you know, get into a chatbot on ChatGPT that teaches you, like, just answers your questions about, you know, basic accounting, or it's even more than basic accounting, because you can train it up to like really know certain things. So I actually created a CPA one and a CFO one. So a CPA one is more client facing, you know, asking questions and everything. Then CFO one is more professional facing. And I was like, you know, I trained the CFO one to know the FASB inside and out, right? And the IRS inside and out. So like they're pulling from those sources to be able to answer your questions and everything. And it's just a real cool way. Again, I think that we should be utilizing AI to help us as much as possible. We shouldn't be afraid of it. It's just like Excel at the end of the day. You know, Excel made everybody's jobs easier. And it's just how you, if you are very great at Excel, then you'll be able to, be leagues ahead of other people, professionals. And so I think the same thing works with AI, and, you know, the GPT is just scratch the surface of what you can really do.
So I'm in ChatGPT right now, and I'm on the Explore GPTs tab. Mm-hmm. And if I type in Kendale King, I see the three GPTs you've created here, CFO GPT and CPA GPT.
Yeah.
All right. That's so cool. So yeah, if you have a ChatGPT subscription, which you should, honestly, if you're listening to this show, you should spend the $20. It's worth it.
Way worth
it. Go check out that GPT that Kendale created. That's awesome. Well, hey, Kendale, thank you so much for your time today. It's been so just fascinating hearing your story and learning about Hollywood Accounting. And everybody go subscribe to, is the podcast called Hollywood Accounting? Is that right?
It is called Hollywood Accounting. Yes.
Okay. Go find it on your podcast player, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, right? Mm-hmm. And subscribe. And Kendale, where do you like to connect with people online? Where should they go if they want to follow you?
LinkedIn is great, again, for professionals. And then I have a YouTube, KCK CPA, as well, as far as, you know, just like regular content, just to consume that. And then I have Instagram is probably the next best one to like for direct, you know, contact back and forth.
Cool. So check out the show notes for links to Kendale's social profiles and website. I've been speaking with Kendale King, CPA, and thanks for joining me. It's been great chatting with you, and I hope to see you around.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and that you learned something new. And if you did, wouldn't it be nice to get some CPE credit for it? Well, I've got great news. My new app, Earmark CPE, offers free NASBA-approved CPE credits for listening to podcasts, including this one. Visit earmarkcpe.com to download the app, take a short quiz, and get your CPE certificate. That's earmarkcpe.com.